Well, greetings everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally and internationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 120 countries worldwide over the Internet. Now, for more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on the rackets when we come back. You know, we Americans are the most litigious people in the world, and we believe in our lawyers with a kind of religious fervor. And we've been taught from early childhood that he who represents himself in court has a fool for a client. But what would you say if a plumber said that? What if your plumber said, "He who fixes his own pipes as a fool for a client"? What if your carpenter said, "He who fixes his own steps as a fool for a client"? Well, doesn't our common sense tell us that a plumber or a carpenter who couldn't fix his own pipes or steps is incompetent? You know, my common sense tells me that a lawyer who couldn't represent himself has to be just as incompetent, just like that plumber or that carpenter. Now listen to James Nielsen. Nielsen is a professor of law at the Hastings Law School. Here's what Professor Nielsen had to say about lawyers. He said, "It's a fact that a student can graduate from this, the fourth largest law school in the United States, and he can do so without ever having written a pleading, a contract, a will, a promissory note, or a deed." And he says it's worse than that. Most students graduate from this law school without ever having seen a real honest-to-God pleading, contract, will, promissory note, or a deed, and a student can graduate without having set foot in a courtroom, without ever having spoken to or on behalf of a person in need of advice or counsel. And a student can graduate without once being exposed to the operation of the rules of court. Now, whatever else may be said about this license issued by the state bar, let it be said that for these students and for their clients, that it is a cruel hoax. Now, that's Professor James Nielsen of the Hastings Law School. Now, if you'd like more information about courtroom strategy and procedure, why don't you call us here at the law school? The number is 417-273-4967. While you're at it, be sure to ask for our free general law CD package. That's a four-hour commentary on the law school. Remember, it's entertaining, it's educational, it's informative, best of all, it's free. You can call and order one right now. The number is 417-273-4967. Now, courtroom strategy and procedure, our school is available on compact disc for adult home education. If you're online, you can go to our website. It's georgegordon.org. Once more, that's georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email and send us an email request for that free general law CD package. Why don't you do it right now while you're thinking about it before you forget? Well, last time we talked about cancer is a racket, but cancer isn't the only racket out there. There's a number of rackets. In fact, I was just sitting here doodling one day, and I came up with about 15 or 20. At the top of the list, I put religion, banking, and the law as the three primary. They're the big biggies in the rackets. We like to talk about the mafia and their loan sharking and prostitution and protection rackets and the numbers rackets, and we blame the mafia for these criminal acts and activities. But while we're blaming the mafia and we're ridiculing and making fun of their numbers racket, have you noticed how government has now taken over the numbers racket and they've renamed it? It's now called the lottery. And we use this lottery to promote and to finance public education, which is another monopoly, which is another racket. I got to looking at racket and I thought, I think I know what it means, but I looked it up in Webster's dictionary and it says it's something that's illegal, or a person who gets money that isn't legal or isn't honest by fraud or by threat or by harm. So when you threaten somebody, this is where the mafia comes in. They used to call this the protection racket. And they'd say to you, "Now, if you don't do this and such, you know, pay us $100 a week every Wednesday when Tony comes in, your store is going to burn down." Now, today we call that insurance. In fact, we have the government over here forcing you to buy insurance whether you want it or not. Now, when the mafia does it, we call it a shakedown racket. When the government does it, we call it law and order. But boys and girls, it violates a law. And any time that you're violating a law, then you've got a criminal activity. And every one of these criminal activities, these rackets, are promoted by government, and every one of them violates the scripture, violates the Mosaic law, violates the law of God, violates the Ten Commandments. Listen to this. Religion violates the Ten Commandments. Did you know that? It's a racket. It's sponsored and promoted by government. Banking is a racket. And it also is sponsored, and it also is promoted by government. The law and lawyers are promoted by government. It's a criminal activity. It's prohibited in Luke chapter 11, banking. And this paper money, these unjust weights and balances, this fifth plank to the Communist Manifesto is prohibited in the Bible in Leviticus 19, verses 35 and 36. The lottery, insurance, government regulation, the income tax, medicine, education, the food industry with their GMOs and radiation, and evolution, which has taken a or created a fraud and taken the place of science by a brand of pseudoscience. And that's what evolution is. It's a pseudoscience which has moved in and taken over the legitimate sciences. And it's a fraud. And the oil crisis and this peak oil and $4 a gallon gas and this carbon tax that they're talking about, it's another fraud. Vaccination is a fraud. Archaeology is a fraud. Chemical fertilizer that we're selling to our farmers is a fraud. It's a racket. It's like archaeology, vaccination, the oil crisis, evolution, food, education, medicine, income tax, government regulation, insurance. These are all rackets. The war on drugs is a racket. It's as phony as a $3 Fed note. The war itself in Iraq and Afghanistan, war itself is a racket. I showed you that last week when we were talking about cancer is a racket. And I put a book out here called War is a Racket by Smedley Butler. Remember the three-star Marine general? It said, I used to work for Harriman and Brown Brothers. It was just a racket. I was a high-class muscle man for the United States Marine enforcing law in Nicaragua and Mexico and Haiti and the Dominican Republic for the benefit of the Wall Street bankers. And that's all you're doing over in Iraq right now, is using the military services of the United States to steal oil from a bunch of Arabs over there, sand jockeys, running around in the desert in the Middle East. And drugs and pharmaceuticals. This whole drug industry out here with all of their vaunted health care and one thing and another, hell, that's a racket. There's been several of these drugs that I've reported on over the years that have killed 50,000 people or more, and the pharmaceutical industry has paid out billions of dollars on these phony drugs that at the time they were being sold, like thalidomide, were being touted as being the saviors of mankind and the protectors of the health, the safety, and the welfare of the American public. And then 3 or 4 years later, they pull it from the market after it's killed 50,000 people or deformed a bunch of people and turned them into little monsters, with no arms and no legs. I guess the word monster is probably a disservice to the people that are disabled that way, but, it's a monstrous outcome for the drug industry, and we all accept it. What else is there? Well, surely there's got to be something better than thalidomide out here, turning people into, wards of the state with no arms and no legs, now wouldn't you say? Now, these people are the victims of these rackets, just like the store owner in New York is the victim of a racket. Well, a lady by the name of Catherine Cryer, she wrote a book called The Case Against Lawyers, and she said, this is how the lawyers, the politicians, and bureaucrats have turned the law into an instrument of tyranny. And then she suggests what we as citizens have to do about it. The lawyers, she says, the politicians and bureaucrats. And so she puts these government agents, politicians, the people you vote for and elect, the Barack Obamas and the John McCain, and the bureaucrats, these are the people that head up and work in the agencies like the Food and Drug Administration, hired, and here's your tax dollars at work, and she kind of takes them to task. Let me give you an illustration. She said in her introduction, from the time I was a little girl, I wanted to be a lawyer, and I was obsessed by the notion of justice. And like the boy who became a marine biologist after witnessing his goldfish being flushed down the toilet, I had my reasons. My heroes were the great trial lawyers of our time, like Clarence Darrow, as portrayed by Spencer Tracy in Inherit the Wind, and Atticus Finch, as portrayed by Gregory Peck in To Kill a Mockingbird. These were the fellows who, in Texas terms, could charm the socks off a rooster, or, better yet, could change the course of human destiny with the force of their words. These were the characters who convinced me that I wanted a career in the law. Now, if you'd asked my mother, she'd tell you I'd argue with a post and had to find a profession that would pay me to do that. Nevertheless, I like my story better, and I'm sticking to it. But as a youngster, I believed our founding fathers had divined a bit of heaven on earth, that they believed that the rule of law could defeat tyranny. Remember, the first immigrants came to this new world to escape arbitrary decrees. For instance, a king, for example, could pronounce a tax on wheat and immediately begin collecting revenues. If he chose, the law would affect only certain segments of the population while his cohorts remained immune. The favored grew wealthy while others starved. Witnessing this injustice, our founding fathers gave much authority instead to the people. They tempered by their representatives and restrained by their constitution and gave Americans the power that would administer the rules for our new society. Lawyers pledged to justice and democracy would be the guardians at the gate, and no one man and no single group of men could arbitrarily or selfishly direct our lives. But there was a catch. As Benjamin Franklin forewarned as he left the Constitutional Convention, a woman asked him, "What sort of government have we, Mr. Franklin?" And he replied, "A republic, madam, if you can keep it." Thomas Jefferson, never the idealist, believed that our countrymen would live up to the challenges of a self-governing society. The pragmatist Franklin had his doubts. An ingenious fellow, Alexis de Tocqueville, described our challenge over a century ago in his monumental work called Democracy in America. And so clearly did he see the strength of a democracy and the weakness of human character. His words might have been written today. He said, in summary, that our real power as a people came through voluntary associations, and our personal freedoms would be protected if we could voluntarily resolve the problem of society rather than permit the heavy hand of government to do it for us. But Tocqueville recognized our great weakness, the willingness to live as strangers apart from the rest. If we lost our communal bond, then authority and social control would arise elsewhere. Man would yield his sovereignty to an immense power, he predicted, one that does not destroy or even tyrannize, but a power that serves to stupefy the people and reduce them to nothing better than a flock of timid and industrious sheep. Now, over the years, as a student of history, politics, and the law, I have concluded that Tocqueville's prediction was correct. While the Constitution and Bill of Rights provided an extraordinary blueprint, the plan actually required appropriate execution by the people. But unfortunately, we Americans have failed to shoulder our responsibilities, and the qualities of active citizenship that Jefferson ascribed to us have not been realized, nor have our appointed leaders lived up to their noble assignment. The rule of law was never meant to be a substitute for community standards. Tocqueville rests his entire case for democracy on our shared values and ideals when he says that, "I am convinced that the happiest situation and the best laws cannot maintain a constitution despite mores, whereas the latter turn even the more unfavorable positions and the worst laws to good account." Tocqueville believed that you and I would actively perform as citizens and express our principles and our concerns in our local communities. Communities, not some distant government in Washington, D.C., but local community would define the rules and laws for society. Members of those local groups were likely to agree on those enactments and obey them accordingly. This shared acceptance is one characteristic that our laws should reflect. There are many others. Most obviously, the law must be known. It isn't today. Today, the IRS agents cannot give us consistent advice at tax time. IRS agents do not know what the tax laws say any more than you and I do. Contractors and manufacturers have thousands of rules to follow governing the smallest activity under our Occupational Safety and Health Administration regulations. No one can possibly know all of these rules and regulations. Police officers can't even rely on a rule book. Police officers, for instance, don't know from case to case whether their judgment is good or bad until some court reviews their conduct. The law must be fair, but the law is not fair. A cigarette smoker gets cancer, and then he collects billions of dollars because he can't kick the habit, while some pathetic drug addict goes to prison. White-collar shysters scam millions and get probation or a stint in Club Fed, while a petty thief does serious time. The death penalty is administered to the poor and often minority defendants where celebrity murderers go free. Now, the law must be reasonable, but it is not. Labels now warn us against the most absurd events. A 13-inch wheel on a wheelbarrow warns, "Not intended for highway use," while an electric router for carpenter says, "This product is not intended for use as a dental drill." These warnings are not a corporate attempt at humor, but they are the results of litigation, serious litigation involving millions of dollars. Rules of due process can keep a bad teacher in the classroom for years, or it can forestall a federal mandate like seat belts for decades. The law should compensate only for legitimate injury caused by someone else, but it does not. If you were exposed to asbestos at some point in your life, and you have never taken ill, never had any ill effects, that doesn't stop you from collecting. Some hacker decides that there's a flaw in computer software, so he sues the manufacturer, although no one has experienced any problems. Never mind, you can still collect. Why not testify to what your loved one may have felt as the car or the plane crashed? That's also compensable. The law should provide for just compensation. It should not unfairly enrich the players. Punitive damages have rocketed into the stratosphere for the lucky plaintiffs who suffer from the right injury. Virtually every lawsuit can be handled on a contingency fee, which makes the attorney a financial partner in the outcome of the case. Class action lawsuits are accepted under the flimsiest of filings, and the lawyers pocket millions of dollars while winning discount coupons for their clients, the people who have actually been damaged. States hire private firms to bankroll and litigate against unpopular defendants, such as the tobacco industry. This practice has created an entire class of billionaire lawyers who have been paid outrageous fees from the public trust. The law should address the concerns of our citizens, yet it is often created and enforced for political reasons. It has nothing to do with our citizens. The tax code is the greatest source of corruption on Capitol Hill, as tax breaks and favors are delivered to big campaign supporters and big business. Lax enforcement and exemption from regulations can be just as valuable to these groups. Just ask Enron. They can tell you. The law must emerge from our legislative process, but often it does not. Lawyers and judges now preempt policy areas that legislatures are not addressing. Entire industries now operate under judicial fiat rather than statutes and regulations, thanks to legal settlements and consent decrees. The big tort lawyers brag on their ability to legislate as they use a court case to rewrite the laws on tobacco, guns, or HMOs. The law should be pragmatic, but it is not. Despite 40 years and billions of dollars, the war against drugs drags on. Statistics plainly show that neither supply nor demand has changed one whit during this battle called the war on drug, and yet we respond with more laws and tougher enforcement in the face of total failure. The same holds true for the death penalty. Study after study demonstrates conclusively the inequity and the injustice that accompanies this punishment. Given the fallible nature of human beings, there's no way to guarantee that only the guilty will be executed and die. We have come to expect everything from the law and very little from ourselves. We do not trust one another to be honest or fair. Subjective decisions are suspect. We want things measured objectively and reduced to writing. The most minute decisions or tasks are now governed by rules that conveniently replace judgment, reason, innovation, and common sense. And yet all the statutes in the world cannot ensure that we have good cops or good teachers or honest politicians. Not everyone loses in this trade-off. In barely a generation, lawyers, politicians, and bureaucrats have taken the place without firing a shot. The palace is now in the hands of government, bureaucrats, politicians, and lawyers. These groups control the creation and enforcement of our laws. It is their ability to write rules and then manipulate these rules at will that has established a new tyranny in America. The rest of us, sometimes willingly, at other times selfishly, or perhaps ignorantly, succumb to these false promises. Believing that these mere words can guarantee security and equality, we have traded away our liberties. We have abdicated our personal responsibility. We now expect the government and courts to compensate for the vagaries of life. Succumbing to divisive rhetoric, we support intrusive laws that unsuccessfully target social and moral behaviors, like hate crimes. Finally, we permit the selective enforcement of rules and the legal giveaway of tax dollars as political favors for those big contributors who feather the political nests of our great leaders and politicians. Our great cornerstone of democracy, the rule of law, has now become a source of power and influence, not liberty and justice. And I resent the insidious manipulations of those entrusted with such authority. But even more, I despise our deliberate ignorance and our passive acceptance of these shackles on the American spirit. We have abdicated our freedom. We have abdicated, literally, our democracy. And we have abdicated to these rulemakers, these bureaucrats and politicians, judges and lawyers. Our institutions now serve these masters. They are the ones clearly winning the game. The rest of us are their timid and industrious sheep. And I say it's time for a citizen's revolt. I say it's time to break the rules. Now, Catherine Cryer is a judge, and she wrote a book on how lawyers, politicians, and bureaucrats have turned our laws into an instrument of tyranny. It's called The Case Against Lawyers. I'm sure you can pick up a copy at Barnes & Noble. If you can't, remember the Brave New Bookstore. The book was written fairly recently. It was published back in 2002. Brave New Bookstore, remember, their telephone number is 512-480-2503. Again, that's 512-480-2503. They're in Austin, Texas. Or you can go online to bravenewbookstore.com. Anytime you can't find a book someplace, just go to bravenewbookstore.com. Now, Judge Cryer points out that we love our rules. We just have to have rules. Sports, she says, has always been a favorite metaphor in American life. It's hard to have a conversation with an American male who doesn't include some reference to goals, yard lines, home runs, Hail Marys, you name it. We've got it. I find an amazing correlation between the way we play our games and the way we live our lives. Compare many European sporting events with American games in soccer or rugby. The play is virtually nonstop. There's only one referee on the field. When infractions occur, the ref approximates the size and size of the foul, the ball is replaced, and play immediately resumes. In American football, the field is covered with officials on top of every play. Yellow flags fly constantly. Chain markers carefully measure every inch the ball progresses. There are constant timeouts for consultation, even videotape review of contested plays. The rules are endless. Arguments abound, and controversial calls will be examined for years. Thank God there is not a level of appeal beyond the head referee. As it is, a game with 60 playing minutes takes three times as long to finish. But we love our rules, and we think they make a game safer. They make the game fairer. They make the game more just. If someone gets injured, it's time to sue the other player. And if we can't sue the player, then we'll sue the equipment manufacturer. If we can't sue the manufacturer, then we'll sue the school. Or maybe we'll sue all three, the players, the equipment manufacturer, and the school. If the referee makes a bad call, we need more cameras for the instant replay. We seem unwilling to accept that there are times when chance, accident, or bias, or corruption will defeat the best rules and the best regulations. So I say, let's get on with life. Get a life. Let's get on with the game. I find it amazing that people who profess to be so rugged, so independent, and so free want even our roughest sport to be made predictable and safe. Now, the rugby players that I know scoff at our wimpy version of football. Imagine, they say, if we put those guys on our field and made them play without pads, essentially nonstop for a full hour, they'd all be dead. This is more than just a metaphor. This is now the American way of life. Name one thing that you did today after rolling off your mattress, which bears a label, do not remove under punishment of law, by the way. You shower in water with the temperature preset by a boiler manufacturer to prevent scalding. You use the hairdryer that warns you against electrocution in the bathtub. You eat breakfast properly labeled for the allergy or calorie conscious. You get into your car as the seatbelt warning light goes ding, 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 and then heading down the road with traffic signs and lights everywhere you turn. That isn't somehow regulated. It's impossible. Your life is totally regulated, even when you sleep. Just take a gander at 10 of my favorite examples from the annual Wacky Warning Label contest sponsored by the Michigan Lawsuit Abuse Watch. Remember, these are all legitimate labels to protect you from yourself. Number 10, the label on a handheld massager advises, do not use while sleeping or unconscious. Here's a label on a public toilet that reads, recycled flush water, unsafe for drinking. Number 8, a can of self-protection pepper spray warns users may irritate eyes. Number 7, no matter how slow the printout, please heed the warning on a laser printer cartridge, do not eat toner. Number 6, a 13-inch wheel on a wheelbarrow warns not intended for highway use. Number 5, a label on prescription sleeping pills warns that they may cause drowsiness. Number 4, a cardboard car sunshield that keeps sun off the dashboard warns, do not drive with sunshield in place. Number 3, bicycle shin guards warn, shin pads cannot protect any part of the body they do not cover. Number 2, a household iron warns, never iron clothes while they're being worn, and don't steam yourself either. I've tried. And finally, my favorite, the 1999 big winner, number 1, parents, please read the baby stroller label that cautions, remove child before folding. Now, these labels are more than just superfluous, nonsensical information. Most of these labels are a response to some lawsuit, as courts have expanded the right to be an idiot. Company lawyers, fearing liability, are madly composing these moronic disclaimers while Washington bureaucrats are codifying them as laws. Now, these are our tax dollars at work. Well, while we mull that one over, boys and girls, let me give you a reminder that you're listening to the Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the law school and the Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. Now, the law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. Now, that's 8 schools in all. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. Now, the law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc, and the law, our website, is updated weekly, and it has our radio log schedule and archives, and all of it can be accessed through the website at georgegordon.org. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the Law School at 417-273-4967. Once again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the Law Hour and editorial review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program. And we often endorse or recommend books, papers, periodicals, and newsletters to our listeners. These endorsements or recommendations that we give do not mean that the authors or publications that we endorse will necessarily reciprocate. Keep in mind that most of these authors and publications cited here on the Law Hour and editorial review may be hostile, political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and editorial review either. Now, these opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They do not necessarily represent the views, the beliefs, or the opinions of the advertisers, sponsors, management, or staff of this radio network or of this local radio station. Now, if you'd like more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org, or you can call the Law School direct at 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about the rackets, plural. Last time I covered the subject matter of cancer is a racket. But I got to thinking about it, and I said, you know, cancer isn't the only racket out there. There's a number of others. Now, when the mafia is engaged in loan sharking, we call that a racket. But when the legislature of Missouri enacts a law, we've got one here. It's called the car title law. And it allows a car title loan company, we call them car title companies, to loan money on the title of your car. And they can charge 9.9% interest per month. 9.9% per month here in Missouri on a car title loan. That's 118% per year. Boys and girls, I can't ever remember the mafia and their loan sharking operations charging 118% a year. The mafia, the highest interest rate I ever heard of that the mafia charged was 32%. Oh, I suppose they probably charged double or something like that. There must have been a time or two, I suppose, when some mafia operation. But we called those guys illegal. We called them rackets. We don't call this racket. Hell, we enforce it with the police power of the state. Now, we have a protection racket. We call it the income tax. If you don't pay this tax, you'll get put in prison. The mafia never put anybody in prison for not paying their shakedown money. They might burn your store down, but hell, you have that covered by insurance anyway. But there's no insurance against not paying your income tax. So the mafia now has to stand aside, and as Catherine Cryer points out in the case against lawyers, that the law has now become a tyranny. It's now become a shakedown. It has now become a racket. Lawyers and the law are a racket. You can get the book at Barnes & Noble. I'm sure Catherine Cryer. It's called The Case Against Lawyers. Her name is spelled C-R-I-E-R, Catherine Cryer. She's a judge. Well-written book. I think you'll love it. But hey, listen, that's just one out of about 20 of these rackets that I got to thinking about. You ever thought about medicine as a racket? Yeah, medicine. Drugs, iatrogenic disease, infection. Well, it is. Cancer is a racket. There are various aspects of the medical practice, pharmaceuticals, and so on that are a racket. But listen to this. It's called iatrogenic disease. It's the third most fatal disease in the United States. Now, remember, the first most fatal disease in America is heart disease. Heart disease. Totally preventable. And modern medicine knows exactly what causes heart disease and how to cure it. We don't want to cure it because we have a medical establishment to support. That's number one. Number two is cancer. Covered that last week. Cancer is a racket. Remember, we talked about that. Compared it to war as a racket. War is a racket, but cancer is a racket. Cancer is the second most fatal disease. Okay, now here's number three. Number three also comes from medicine. It's called iatrogenic disease, spelled I-A-T-R-O-G-E-N-I-C. It's the third most fatal disease in the United States. Iatrogenic disease is defined as a disease that is caused by medical treatments. Let me underline that. Maybe you missed that. Let me underline that. Iatrogenic disease, the third most fatal disease in America, the third disease behind cancer and heart disease, is defined as a disease that is caused by medical treatment. You're not feeling good, so you go to the doctor, the hospital, the clinic, the nurse, the practitioner, for medical treatment and the doctor kills you. Well, that's the worst case scenario. It's called iatrogenic disease, doctor-induced disease. It's the medical treatment that kills you. Third most fatal. Now, iatrogenic disease covers three aspects. It covers drugs, infection, and doctor mistakes. For instance, the doctor, he's going to cut out your left lung, and that's because you've got lung cancer. And so the prescription here is we're going to operate on you and cut out your left lung. Okay. But somebody comes in, and they put the doctor in the operating room, and maybe he's on the right side of the operating table, and he's left-handed. Maybe he's right-handed, and he's on the right side, or he's on the side of the table in which he's looking at the patient, and he concludes that the right lung is actually the left lung, or the left lung is actually the right lung. Is the doctor facing the patient, determining that the lung is the right lung or the left lung, or is the left lung the one from the perspective of the patient who's looking out of his eyeball straight ahead? You know, if I'm looking out my eyeball straight ahead, my left lung is on my left side. But if I'm the doctor facing the patient lying on the table, then my left lung is actually the other side, and it's my right lung. All right, well, doctors, many, many times, every single year, when they're cutting out the lung of a patient who has lung cancer, they cut out the wrong one. They cut out the healthy one and leave the cancer lung inside the patient. Okay, they got a label for that. It's a mistake. It's a doctor's mistake. It's called iatrogenic disease. Or let's say the doctor is going to operate on you and he cuts out the wrong body part. Or he leaves a sponge or something inside of you which punctures you and then gives you gangrene and you die from it. Or you don't have to die from it. About 100,000 patients a year die from iatrogenic disease. That's the actual doctor mistake. The truth of the matter is iatrogenic disease doesn't kill just 100,000, it kills 300,000. And they break it down in three categories, drugs. When the doctor prescribes a drug for you, this drug may be the wrong drug, or it may be the right drug with the wrong dosage. It's not an illegal drug. We're not talking about some drug addict down on the street corner selling you heroin and you overdose on the heroin. That kills 6,000 people a year. But doctors who prescribe the wrong drug or the wrong dose of the right drug or the wrong dose of the wrong drug, they kill 130,000 people a year. Now, this is what they admit to. Most authorities believe that it's double that, at the minimum, double that, 260,000. But what they admit to is 130,000. Well, okay, we admit we kill 130,000 people a year by prescribing the wrong drug. Excuse me, boys and girls. But all of the illegal drugs in America combined with all of the thousands and maybe millions, I don't know, but certainly thousands of illegal drug dealers and millions of illegal drug users only kill 6,000 people a year. And the medical profession using legal drugs sold through legal channels at your local Osco Buttery drugstore or Rexall prescription drugstore kills 130,000. Let's just take 130, divide that by 6. That's 21 times more people being killed by doctors and pharmacists and everybody else on just drugs alone, called iatrogenic disease. Okay, there's a second factor that comes in. I just mentioned that one. That's cutting out the wrong lung. That kills 100,000 people a year. 100,000. In addition to the drugs now. The doctor mistakes kill 100,000. When we include that with drugs, it's 230,000. That's what they admit to. Okay, there's one more category. Kills 97,000 people a year, and that's disease. You go to the hospital because you've got a disease. While you're there, the doctor cures your disease, but you die from streptococcus or some other infectious disease that you picked up in the hospital. Yeah, that's right. In other words, you went to the hospital because you needed your appendix cut out or your gallbladder or something else, or you broke a leg or they had to do some surgery. And while you were in the hospital, you picked up this super bug and you died from it. Now, you can read the major headlines around the world on this serious disease. How prepared are you to avoid becoming a national statistic? If a jumbo jet loaded with 280 people crashed every day, 365 days a year, year after year after year, would you be concerned about flying? Would you question the Federal Aviation Administration, and would you demand answers? Think about that. Well, close to 100,000 people dying every year from plane crashes? Does that sound ridiculous? Well, think again. What if you were told that over 100,000 people are killed and over 2 million people maimed and disabled every year, year after year, from modern medicine? Would you believe that statement? See, if I came along, if George Gordon came in the door and said, doctors kill 100,000 people a year from iatrogenic disease, you know, you'd probably say, well, Gordon, you know, you've slipped a cog here. My God, that's preposterous. That can't happen in America. This is America has the best medical care, the best medical technology in the world. And I think that's probably a true statement. You can take somebody shot with a 45 in the chest. You know, take a look at President Reagan. I mean, he was shot through the lungs. They took him to the hospital and saved his life. Now, that's no small trick. You know, when you get shot through the lungs, you're dead. Or, you know, you might not die in the next 5 minutes, but, you know, in the next day or two, you're going to die. President Lincoln was shot, and then he died. Medical science couldn't save him. Today, if President Lincoln had been shot, they would have rushed him into the trauma center, and they would have saved his life. President Lincoln was shot. He was mortally wounded. If President James A. Garfield or President William McKinley, you know, they were both shot. They lived for a while after they'd been shot. Had they been taken to a modern hospital today with the trauma care that we have available, hell, they'd have all survived. So I'm not down on modern medicine. I'm just pointing out here that 100,000 people a year die in our hospitals because of doctor errors. And every one of these errors is compensable. I mean, you can sue the doctor and collect money for the wrongful death or for the disease or for, you know, the cause of whatever happened to you. The disease or the illness. Now, it sounds ridiculous when you say 100,000 people a year die every year from medical causes. Well, think about it again. What if you were told that over 100,000 people are killed and over 2 million people maimed and disabled every year, year after year, from modern medicine? Would you believe that? Well, these may be my words, but read the following articles from the most respected medical journals and institutions, such as the Journal of the American Medical Association, Harvard University, the Center for Disease Control, the British Medical Journal, The Lancet, New England Journal of Medicine, The National News, New York Times, Washington Post, CNN, U.S. News and World Report, and you be the judge. Now, writing in the Journal of the American Medical Association, it's called JAMA, J-A-M-A, Dr. Starfield has documented the tragedy of the traditional medical paradigm in the following statistics. The term iatrogenic is defined as induced in a patient by a physician's activity, manner, or therapy, used especially to pertain to a complication of treatment. Furthermore, these estimates of death due to error are lower than those in recent institutes of medical report. If the higher estimates are used, the deaths due to iatrogenic causes would range from 230,000 to 284,000 a year. But even at the lower estimate of 225,000 deaths per year, this constitutes the third leading cause of death in the United States. Third leading cause, even if you take the lower number. And Dr. Starfield offers several caveats in the interpretations of these numbers. First, most of the data are derived from studies in hospitalized patients. Second, these estimates are for deaths only, and they do not include the many negative effects that are associated with disability or discomfort. Third, the estimates of death due to error are lower than those in the IOM report. If the higher estimates are used, the deaths due to iatrogenic causes would range from 230,000 to 284,000. In any case, 225,000 deaths per year constitutes the third leading cause of death in the United States after deaths from heart disease and cancer. And even if these figures are overestimated, there's a wide margin between these numbers of deaths and the next leading cause of death, which is called cerebrovascular disease. Another analysis concluded that between 4 and 18% of consecutive patients experience negative effects in outpatient settings with 116 million extra physician visits. Okay, so your doctor screws up, which requires that you come back for more physician visits. It causes 116 million people to come in and get at least one extra visit or some combination of visits in the number of patients. 77 million extra prescriptions, 17 million emergency department visits, 8 million hospitalizations, 3 million long-term admissions, 199,000 additional deaths, and $77 billion in extra costs. That's the cost of doctor error. Isn't that amazing? Now, your doctor making a mistake, treating you for a disease, treating you for some affliction, causes you and every other American 116 million extra physician visits, 77 million extra prescriptions, 17 million emergency department visits, 8 million hospitalizations, 3 million long-term admissions, 199,000 deaths, and $77 billion in extra costs. This costs $77 billion. Now, that's the cost that's directly charged. That doesn't count the funerals. You know, 199,000 funerals cost some money, too. But when you have to go for these extra physician visits, aren't you taking time off work? Hey, they're not counting in your lost productivity to your boss or to the national economy or to your paycheck next Friday. The high cost of healthcare, our healthcare system, is considered to be a deficit, but it seems to be tolerated under the assumption that better health results from more expensive care. However, evidence from a few studies indicates that as many as 20 to 30% of patients receive inappropriate care. Hell, that's 20 percent, you know, that's a fifth to a third. You're spending your money, but you're not getting your money's worth. And your chances of getting killed, you know, are pretty damn good. That's the other side of it. Well, I just thought I'd pass that one on to you. Medicine, oven by itself, is a racket. We're told in the Bible, in Exodus 15, verse 26, that these diseases that we're suffering from are caused by sin. It's caused by you not following the laws that are laid down in the Scripture. And the doctor is aiding and abetting you by not informing you as to what these laws are and the fact that you're violating these laws, and that's what's making you sick to start with. Because it makes the doctor $77 billion more money. I mean, I'm not suggesting that he's mistreating you so that he can get you to come back so that he'll have something else to treat you for. But nobody's doing anything about it. Now, if a jumbo jet carrying 200 or 300 people were crashing every day, you can rest assured that the FAA would be on top of that. There was a case of the MD-80 not too long ago. They grounded the whole fleet because there's supposed to be five straps holding a hydraulic line, and they were only putting three straps on. So the FAA come in, they said, okay, ground all the MD-80s and make sure they got all five straps. No MD-80 crashed because of these straps being off or not being put on. But the FAA was right on top of that, and maybe they should be. I'm not suggesting that they should let those airplanes fly without all five of those straps on the hydraulic line. But I'm pointing out that if it's important to put all five straps on the hydraulic lines to prevent death and injury, isn't it more important that we do something constructive from the FDA or the Department of Agriculture or Congress or somebody to prevent or to lessen or reduce the death toll from doctors that kill 130,000 people a year that they admit to? Now, this guy says, no, it's probably more like 225,000. Now, he's including the 300,000. He's including all three in some of what he's telling us, and he's just talking about one in other places. So keep in mind, it's drugs, misdiagnosis. I mean, the doctor says that you've got some disease that's harmless, but you've really got cancer. And then when they send you to the hospital, they kill you with an infectious disease. How do you like that? Two rackets, the law and medicine. Hey, I'm out of time, your kids. I'm going to have to remind you that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour and the editorial review is heard 7 days a week here in the United States and around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Hey, time's up. I got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.